Hello everyone, I'm Ian Katz, Deputy Editor of The Guardian, and welcome to The Guardian's Green Debate. This is the one that ITV and Sky actually wanted. Given that just a few short months ago, almost everyone, it seems, agreed that climate change in particular was one of the most pressing problems facing us, it's quite striking how absent the environment in general and climate change has been from this campaign. I think I'm right in saying that it was completely absent from the first leaders' debate. Now, our panel, and I should just say I should start with Simon Hughes, the Lib Dem spokesman on climate change and energy. Next, we've got Ed Miliband, climate change and energy secretary. Finally, we've got Greg Clark, the Tory spokesman on climate change and energy. I'm going to ask the panel to crack into those pithy 2 minutes opening statements, and we're going to start with Ed Miliband, please.
Thanks, Ian. I've been a Secretary of State since October 2008, and in that time, we have taken a number of steps, of ambitious steps on climate change, including banning new dirty coal power stations. We've become the world leader in offshore wind. We've introduced feed-in tariffs, and we've done a number of other things. But I'm under no illusions about the scale of the task that greets us in the next Parliament. And I think the central election question is, how do we widen the circle of the committed on climate change and tackling climate change? And I think there are three things that we need to do. First of all, we need to make ourselves a green industrial powerhouse. So far, we've had four of the five biggest offshore wind manufacturers say they're going to come to Britain and locate here. The reason they're doing that is because we have shown in the last 18 months that we can have an active industrial policy pushing money into green investment, and we want to do more of that with a green investment bank. We want to use the regional development agencies to make that happen too. So first of all, we have to have a green industrial future. Secondly, we've got to empower people. Feed-in tariffs were introduced in April of this year. Next year, we will introduce a renewable heat incentive to persuade people to introduce low-carbon heat into their homes. And we also want to see, at local community level, co-ops forming, and we will encourage that in the next Parliament. But thirdly, the most important ingredient to tackle climate change and take people with us is fairness. Because we won't take people with us unless they think that the way we're tackling climate change is fair. So, for example, in the next Parliament, we've said that we will regulate private sector landlords to ensure that some of the poorest people in our society get the benefits of energy efficiency. We're going to cut energy prices for the vulnerable through social tariffs. And just as we want fairness at home, so we want fairness abroad as well. And that means fulfilling our commitments to the world's poorest people, including honouring the important promises that were made at Copenhagen and leading in Europe on tackling climate change and having a global deal. So I'm realistic about the scale of the challenge. I think we can present people with an inspiring vision, which is of a green Britain, a Britain that leads in the industrial jobs of the future, a Britain that empowers people to tackle climate change in their own communities, and a Britain that is fair.
Greg, I have to give you 2.5 minutes.
I might not need all that. 5 years ago, we couldn't have had this debate. Climate change featured hardly at all in the last general election campaign. And I think even with the recession and various other things, I hope that this is going to rise up the agenda during this campaign. But I think two things have happened in the last 5 years to change what was always an important part of the policy agenda to be part of the political agenda. I think the first is a tribute to many people in this room who were part of a grassroots movement through campaigns like The Big Ask, through 1010, to actually force politicians to take seriously action on climate change. I think it was a taste of the new politics quite early on, and I think it's had revolutionary effects, and I think it's a fantastic thing. The second thing that I think happened in the last 5 years is that when David Cameron was elected leader of the Conservative Party, he galvanised the interest in the parties in this. For the first time, you had a leader of a party who was putting climate change right shop front, right at the beginning, and we've continued that right throughout the last 5 years, and it's reflected now in our manifesto. Now, sometimes it's not easy making a stand, and some of the action that needs to be taken to combat climate change isn't easy. It requires tough decisions, and sometimes it's easy to promise things that you never expect to be able to deliver. It's very easy just to choose targets without actually thinking about how you're going to achieve them. But we are very clear and very determined that if we are elected to government, there is an opportunity facing Britain and the world to leave behind the talk and get really into a new phase of action action that I think enjoys already a degree of cross-party consensus. And I think if we can do that and we can translate our ambitions and our ideals into real change on the ground in this country and around the world during the next 5 years, then the next parliament, I think, will be a parliament we can all be proud of.
Thank you.
Simon. We've come here for a debate on energy and climate change, but actually the debate is much broader than that. Liberal Democrats have understood for years that environment and climate change issues touch every part of our lives and every part of government policy. And that's why, and I commend it to you, if you look in our manifesto, you will see that environmental policy is integrated into every area of policymaking, for example, including defence. Britain today faces three crises: an economic crisis, an environmental crisis, and a political crisis. And we can't solve one without solving the others. We won't be able to recover from our economic difficulties if we continue to rely on finite resources and we waste much of what we have available to us. Moving towards a new and renewable economy will be the only way to create new jobs and return to sustainable growth. If we'd started this transition decades ago, when the technology was already becoming available, we would not be in the crisis we're in today. But instead of taking those choices, the parties of vested interests continue to frustrate much of the needed change by looking after the short-term interests of their friends and associates. Some of us saw this coming. Some of us, me included, have been campaigning on these issues for 30 years. But our voices were simply not listened to by government because we have a broken political system which did not listen to the diversity of views that people like you and I have espoused. So in this election, if people have the courage of their convictions and hold to them and are willing to vote positively for coherent economic and environmental policies for the next generation, we have a real chance to change politics so we can change our economy and protect our environmental future at the same time. The opportunity hasn't come a moment too soon. The best scientific evidence tells us overwhelmingly that global emissions must peak and decline by 2016, or the changes that the climate may bring us may be catastrophic. So next month could see the opportunity of electing the last parliament with the ability to affect that outcome for the good. And I would ask you at the end of this evening to agree that the Liberal Democrats are the only party with the vision and the strength, but also the experience and the commitment to deliver that in tough times ahead.
I'd like to start with a question from someone who promisingly goes by the name of Junk Mail. What do the parties think of the recent New Economic Foundation report that suggests that expanding Heathrow will result in a £5 billion loss to the UK economy? Greg, do you want to start?
We've been very clear that we're against the third runway at Heathrow. I think the approach to predict and provide is not going to get us into a position of meeting our climate change objectives. I think it's a failure of imagination just to think that there aren't better alternatives. I mean, who of us would choose to fly short distances when there is a train that can whisk you from city centre to city centre? So I think we need to invest and catch up with other countries by having a functioning high-speed rail network across this country linked into the continent that can then reduce the demand for slots at Heathrow. It's better for everyone, it's better experience, and it's better for our carbon footprint. Ed.
I think this is a very important issue, aviation emissions, and I'll come to the issue of Heathrow in a second. We have said, and we're the first country in the world to do this, that we will restrict aviation emissions by 2050 to their current levels. That will require significant constraints on passenger demand. And that is part of an approach that says if we want to cut by 80% across the board by 2050, we should do more in those areas where there are alternatives, and we may have to do less in other areas. But flying will become more expensive as a result, and there'll be significant constraints on passenger demand. On the issue of Heathrow, that can fit within that framework, but we've said that only 50% of the slots on the third runway can go ahead, the other 50% subject to that target. What Greg didn't tell you is that he's in favour of airport expansion in the southeast. He just won't tell you which airport he wants it to happen at.
Simon. Yeah, we've been opposed to the third runway at Heathrow for a very long time indeed. And we believe that the government was not being honest about the figures that it knew and had available to it. Ed is right to say that this shouldn't be looked at as a one airport issue. And we have always said that it's the whole of the southeast of England. But we have to make alternatives cost beneficial, which means lower rail fares, as well as high-speed rail. And we have to stop the tax system which means there's an incentive to fly with half-empty planes and tax on the planes that fly rather than the passengers that fly.
Greg, I'm going to come back to you because the charge from Ed there is that you've gone for the crowd-pleasing position on Heathrow.
Well, I think it's a tough decision. I think if you're not going to have a third runway at Heathrow, you do need to have high-speed rail, and it should link in. So under our proposals, we've said that we should have a station at Heathrow so people can, whether they're coming transatlantic flights, for example, they can get on to a high-speed rail network so they don't need to take domestic European flights or internal domestic flights. So you do need that coherent approach.
You can't have a one-airport policy. These are tough decisions. We've seen with the Icelandic volcano incident that lots of people rely on flying for economic reasons, for social reasons, and you know, the world is coming closer together, not getting further apart in terms of immigration, migration to other places. Now, I say that the aviation has to make its contribution to cutting emissions, but at least I set a proper target for what we need to do and what contribution it needs to make. Now, agree with it or disagree with it, but say what your position is. Do you agree with my target, or should it be more stringent?
Let people get off the plane at Heathrow and get onto a high-speed train.
But of course, and we're in favour of high-speed rail.
But not a station at Heathrow.
Well, come on, look, less than 10% of Heathrow's traffic is to do with domestic aviation.
And you've got to pay... And short-haul European?
Well, some of it may
be
short-haul.
Short-haul European, going to Paris, going to Brussels, going to, so you, to near-continental destinations.
Do you subscribe to my target for 2050?
Take the domestic flights, then you've got a substantial proportion of people who could get off the plane at Heathrow and get onto a cleaner alternative.
We need to start the cultural shift which says there are many things that don't need plane travel. Many business deals that can be done by video conferencing and the like. It's a cultural shift.
The next question is from someone called Genoa Witness, a snappy name on the website. And the question is, how are you going to deal with climate sceptics and the fallout from Climategate? Ed, do you want to kick this one off?
I think there's two things that we need to do to deal with climate sceptics. First of all, we have to be open and transparent about the science, about the data, about any mistakes that have been made. But secondly, we have to be incredibly robust about making clear what is actually happening. We have the highest CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere for 600,000 years, and I was with actually a class doing A-level physics today, and they were talking to me about this too. It's absolutely clear that there is a clear effect, a clear scientific effect of extra carbon in the atmosphere and a heating up of the planet. I think it's a responsibility on all politicians to take on the sceptics, to point out to the public the reality, and also, frankly, to mobilise the scientists around this issue.
Simon.
And you have to firstly look at the balance of the science. I was always clear, having been to the University of East Anglia several times and talked to the team there, that they were not fiddling the figures, that they were not trying to reinvent the facts. We as a country need to make sure, whatever the difficulties of the recession, we need to sustain our science and technology and research budgets. And thirdly, I'm going to be blunt about this, you don't elect a Tory government, because the majority of Tory MPs and candidates, at least a third of the MPs, do not believe that the climate crisis is made by human beings.
Well, that's not my experience. I've had this portfolio for the same time as Ed. I think the policies that we have advanced, we were absolutely clear going into Copenhagen that we wanted to have an ambitious deal. There was no sense in which there was any suggestion that that shouldn't be the case. It's important that we have that deal. I think if you look at our manifesto, the policies that we have are the most far-reaching in terms of decarbonising the economy that we've ever had. So I do think we need to be robust about the arguments. Why not do what politics should be about, surely? Politics should be about persuading people, bringing them around to what I think is an overwhelming and imperative case. And if you do that, I think this is something that the Green Movement and everyone, as we all are, who are committed to decarbonise the economy, can engage in with great prospects of success.
Let's stay with this for one second, just to say. So, Simon, does Greg have a point here that actually shouting down sceptics a little too forcefully is perhaps a kind of intolerance that has actually bred further the kind of scepticism that we've seen?
Yes, you don't do it by shouting down, you do it by winning the argument. But Greg misrepresents the balance of views. I mean, Greg is right, of course, there are people in the Labour and our party who haven't got that view, but they are a minority.
This is a long question, but it's a good one, I think. It's from Roger Pilker Jr. Academic research has shown that for the UK to meet the emissions reductions targets implied by the 2008 Climate Change Act would require an effort the equivalent of 30 new nuclear power plants by 2015, just to get partway to the target. Clearly this isn't going to happen. Ed.
It's not all but certain to fail, and I don't agree with the figures that you cited. because we've shown sector by sector how we will meet our commitments on climate change to 2020, which is for a 34% reduction in emissions. We've already got about a 20% reductions in emissions compared to 1990. We have to embrace all the low-carbon alternatives at our disposal and nuclear power.
Simon. It's a major difference of policy between us on the one hand and the Labour and Tory parties on the other. We don't believe that nuclear power is the solution. And I could give you a long list, I'll give you a short list. Starting now, we're not going to be able to deliver power from a new second generation of nuclear power stations in time to deal with the crisis that we're told is coming in the middle of the next decade. They are phenomenally expensive. They're often going to go for investing in the nuclear option rather than in renewables. And we don't have necessarily the capability to have all the investment in both. It will undermine our ability to develop the renewables as much as we need. And here's Britain, wind, wave, tidal power and everything else waiting to be exploited.
Greg.
I think we do need investment in nuclear. The shame is that we had this gap between the end of the current fleet of nuclear power plants and the earliest date at which new ones can open. But I do think we need it.
Ed, you accept that we're going to, at some point, face a horrific bill for this new nuclear programme?
No, because I think we've learned the lessons. And what is one of the primary lessons? It is the cost, the legacy cost of waste. And that's why we have made the companies put money aside, and we're currently in negotiation about how much money this will be, put money aside to cover the cost of legacy waste. I do want to come back to Simon, though, because there's no question that in some parts of the Green movement, although not all, this is a popular, not to say populist, position. But the question is it the right position? Simon, we're saying that we're going to increase the amount of renewables in our generating capacity sixfold between now and 2020 at considerable cost, onshore and offshore wind, marine, etc. I honestly don't see, and I've obviously looked at the figures very carefully in my job, I honestly don't see how going forward you plug that gap in a sustainable way. And I looked on the website when you did your calculation today for the Guardian about your plans. I just don't see how you fill the gap.
The key reason we can meet our targets is by reducing the amount of energy UK PLC uses. And when we have today 1 out of 100 homes in Britain being energy efficient.
I'm going to give Ed the last word on this one.
I mean, I just have to say to you, of course we want to drive forward on energy efficiency, and we have ambitious plans on that, as I said in the opening. But one of the things that has held us back on renewables is Conservative councils that turned down about 3/4 of wind generating capacity.
Why do your councils disproportionately turn down wind power applications?
Because we have more councils and they're more likely to be in rural areas.
That's not true.
Which is where wind farms tend to be built. And actually George Monbiot in The Guardian wrote a piece recently. Look at what they do on the continent. If you look at Denmark, for example, which, as everyone knows, has the greatest penetration and success of onshore wind, 80% of those wind farms started out community-owned. And they enjoy positive, enthusiastic support. In George's piece, he was pointing out some communities in this country that jointly own it. So what we say is rather than try to politicise this or try to demonise these people as being bad people, why not actually change the terms of the debate?
OK, I think we need to go to closing statements. And after extensive negotiations, Simon is first up.
Apart from a few sceptics, there's a broad consensus in our country that we need to take urgent action. I think we've had that reaffirmed tonight. So if for you and for the country we're going to make climate change a priority, I want you to ask yourselves a very simple question. Who can you trust most to deliver the agenda? Can you trust a fourth successive Labour government to deliver, government with policy on energy climate change, which has been built around a series of targets that are regularly missed? Can you trust, in spite of Greg's engaging style, a party which have the candidate members and supporters galore who don't even believe in the urgency, and others who see it as a mechanism, a PR mechanism of winning support? Or will you trust us, the Liberal Democrats, a party which has consistently campaigned on all of these issues for the whole life of the party and its predecessor parties, and the membership and the leadership have voted for and engaged in that all its time? So I want you to go away today looking at our record. It's the best opportunity in my political lifetime to have enough people in government who really believe in this priority. It's up to you to deliver that.
Greg.
I think you need to go by the evidence, a bit like the climate change science. I think you need to go with the evidence. And the evidence, I think, of the last 13 years is, for whatever Ed's intentions and ambitions, the record has been disappointing in terms of what we've done practically to decarbonise the economy. Using more fossil fuels, have one of the worst renewable records in Europe. So I think the question is, if you want to have 13 more years of that, then vote for the party that you think is most likely to continue Gordon Brown's government, whichever of them that is. But if you want a government that I think has ambitious plans contained in the manifesto to really get on with the practical action of decarbonising the economy, then I think you'll find that David Cameron's Conservatives offer an opportunity to put that change into practice.
So I think this has been a very good debate tonight. I want to thank the audience and my opponents for coming along. We are willing to embrace all the low-carbon alternatives to tackle the huge problem of climate change. Greg and Simon aren't. We don't have a bunch of climate change deniers as our candidate. Greg does. And we will play a leading role in Europe and not stand on the sidelines. And so there are big differences at this election. We have a vision of a country going green with jobs for people, which is fair and just. I think it is very different to the image making of the Conservative Party. And I think that our philosophy, values and policies can get Britain the kind of green transition it needs.
Thank you all. Thank you for a fantastic audience. I apologise to the many of you who had questions to answer and didn't get them out. I'm sorry, I'm a useless timekeeper. The spin teams will be in the spin room afterwards, spinning furiously if you really want to know what they were actually saying. Thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you. That was great.
Thank you. You didn't ask about feed-in tariffs.